Hello and welcome to the Rock Your Voice podcast. Vocal coaching tips that will transform your voice, interviews that will inspire, industry guidance, and so much more. Without further ado, let's get on with the show.
Today on the Rock Your Voice podcast, I'm joined by Kurt Dahl, aka Lawyer Drummer. He is a musician who has toured North America with his band One Bad Son. His band has scored 5 top 10 singles and a number one song. They've released 9 albums with various artists. They've toured arenas with Def Leppard, Shinedown, Judas Priest, and have also shared the bill with none other than the Rolling Stones. But as much as I love talking to Kurt about music, I did also want to get him on because he's also an entertainment lawyer, one of my very favorite. Can you have a favorite lawyer? I mean, do people even like lawyers? Kurt is an anomaly because he's the most fantastic human and a fantastic lawyer and a fantastic musician. I am going to stop talking now and let you listen to our conversation where you're going to get tons of insights about entertainment law and the music industry. Thanks for joining me, Kurt.
So this could potentially be a doubleheader. It's kind of like a two-part because we get two for one here. We get a musician and an entertainment lawyer. Amazing journey that you've been on, Kurt. So let's start from the start. I'm assuming the music came before the legal side of things.
That is definitely what came first. The fact that I'm such a music lover and music is such a part of my life, I mean, that's really what led me to entertainment law.
Was it born out of kind of a need that you got into the legal thing? Was it you saw from the music side, you're like, there's no one doing this the way it should be being done?
Well, yeah, good question. I mean, honestly, I read so many biographies of so many of my idols, right?
Right. Like,
I soaked that up. To me, that was in my late teens, 20s, like, that's all I did. I just read biographies. Right. I was obsessed with it. I listened to records obsessively. You know, I'm sure you're similar. And one of the common threads with all of those biographies and all of my idols was they all got screwed over by someone in a suit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I thought, well, what if I became the suit and helped musicians, you know, rather than hinder them, you know? So, and then, you know, and I guess selfishly, I was in a band and I thought, yeah, if I become a lawyer, I'd protect my band. But I think it was a lot more than that. I felt like, you know, a need to just be out there and be the guy that was helping fellow musicians, you know.
I love that so much. And it's so true. I don't think there is a story of a successful band that has not been screwed over. Like, what is that? Why is that?
Well, you know, I've got theories, but I mean, I think a big part of it is, and I see it to this day, it's like, it's because we're in the industry of dreams, you know, and dreamers, right? So there's always that carrot being dangled.
Yeah.
And when someone's dreams are at stake, like they'll sign a deal that they otherwise wouldn't.
Yes.
And, you know, if other lawyers see the kind of deals that I do, like lawyers that aren't entertainment lawyers, they say, well, this would never fly in the regular business world, but in the music business, it would, right? Even just the return on investment when you sign a record deal. I mean, it's crazy, right? So I think that's part of it. It's like, and then I think also artists can, or at least they were, I think maybe they still are, they're easier to exploit, unfortunately, because they're so often the brain is on the creative side, not on the business side. Now there's exceptions, of course, but you know, I think a lot of times it's like they get taken advantage of by these, you know, sort of business sharks.
Absolutely. Did you, like, it's so funny actually, Jason, my husband and I were talking yesterday about how the music industry just, it always has from inception been a bit of a Wild West situation. Like, there's very few things that are regulated, or like even what I do, voice coaching, it's not a regulated industry. It's all kind of like you go out, you find someone who fits the bill and you work with them and off you go. It's like, for you, from your side of things, having a very regulated industry, it must be really interesting to see the madness that is the music industry and like how on earth do you kind of make sense of it? Like, what's your thought on the sort of Wild West side of things? Do you think it's great for the creativity, or do you think it's just like we do need to kind of start figuring out X, Y, and Z and creating more of a clear path of how things are done?
You know, I think the Wild West nature has created some of the great, like, music industry professionals, right?
Yes.
Like, some of the great managers of all time just had no experience managing. They just kind of stepped into the role and became, you know, I'm thinking of, like, like Led Zeppelin's manager, yes. Peter Grant, was just like a professional wrestler. And he was like, because he was 7 feet tall and 350 pounds, no one messed with him. But,
right.
you know, he didn't go to school, you know,
right.
let alone school for managing the biggest rock band in the world.
Totally.
You know, and he also had his downsides, of course. But I mean, he was just, I would say if you're Led Zeppelin, you couldn't have picked a better manager. Right.
So I
think same with some of the great record execs of all time. I mean, yeah. they just had no, like they almost, it's like if they didn't succeed in the music biz, they would have succeeded in, you know, some sort of criminal underworld. But
totally.
They, and the music biz does have a lot of unfortunate ties to the mob over the years and all that
mm-hmm,
sort of stuff. But
mm-hmm.
so yeah, to your point, I mean, I think for me, that sort of Wild West mentality, I mean, I rarely see two deals that are the same. And I think that's my role, is just to always protect, you know, especially I'm repping the artists, of course, but
yeah.
even if I'm repping labels and managers, I mean, you know, I like the wild, sort of that intrepid entrepreneurial view on things, right?
Yes.
And so you can draft a deal, especially in 2024. I mean, deals are more different now from each other than they ever have been, right?
Yes.
You can get creative and find ways to make success for both sides, label and artist, or manager and artist, you know?
Absolutely.
So I think some of the most, you know, intelligent, creative people I've ever met are in the music biz, and hopefully they're also good people, so they can use that to not exploit the other side, right?
Right. It is a bit of a wild west out there, but that does allow for the creativity, like you said. And I think that does allow for some really cool people to come into the space and to do new things and all of that stuff. But with regards to kind of what you do, and I love it because we've worked together on quite a few things, and I'm always telling my clients to come see you and stuff, because you're a heart-centered lawyer. You're a perfect mix of rock and roll and the sensible side of things too, and having that focus on the best interest for the artists. What are the biggest things that you've seen happen? I mean, obviously you can't give perfect, like, clear examples of who and what, but what are sort of examples of things where people are rushing into stuff, or what are the kind of red flags that artists should be looking for when, like you said, they're all about the dreams and suddenly what they might perceive as an amazing opportunity is put in front of them? What are sort of red flags to look for when they're in that situation?
Yeah, good question. I think first and foremost, there is sort of these really sketchy deals out there, sketchy people. I mean, I always say, like I alluded to earlier, some of the most amazing, generous, intelligent, funny, creative people I've ever met in the world are in the music industry.
Yeah.
And then also in the music industry is some of the, there's snakes, right?
Yeah.
And it's probably 50-50,
yeah.
I would say. So your odds are okay, I guess, but not that great in terms of if you meet someone. Thankfully, I only work with the good half, right? And
yeah.
I have that luxury, having done this as long as I have. I can see the other half coming a mile away, and
right.
I don't work with them. But
awesome.
So there is sort of like these sketchy deals come along. So I guess the number one rule for artists, like if it seems too good to be true, it probably is
mm-hmm.
too
mm-hmm.
good to be true. And that's,
yeah.
you know, because sometimes you see these deals, like right now there's this one company, I won't say the name, but because
yeah.
they've already started to at me and things and try to attack
Ooh.
Me online. But it's a sketchy label that they make the artist pay a bunch of money up front. And then, but they promise, you know, $100,000 once they get that, you know, say $5,000 up front. And of course, artists pay the $5,000 and never
yes.
hear from them again, right? So that's just a straight ripoff, right?
Yeah.
But it's more or less obvious sort of ripoffs or issues that may arise. So I think just number one, just, you know, don't just take the first offer that's put on your table.
Yeah.
And I see that happens sometimes, right? Like I get it. You're working
yeah.
so hard as an artist, and you know that you need someone on your team, or you need people on your team to get
mm-hmm.
to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
You've done everything you can. So just don't take that first deal though, like,
yeah.
or at the very least, like bring it to me or bring it to a lawyer just to get an opinion.
Absolutely.
Right. So I think one of the mistakes that I see happen sometimes is, yes, yeah, so an artist starts to really, you know, resonate. Maybe a song does something on Spotify or TikTok or Instagram, and then they sign the first deal, and then like a month later they find out they could have got five way better deals, right? So just don't rush into things, I would say. Always proceed sort of cautiously and slowly,
right?
And if someone's giving you a deadline of, you know, Friday by 5 o'clock,
okay.
that's usually a red flag.
Yeah, I was gonna say, is that kind of like when a label really wants you and wants you to see you succeed, I'm assuming that kind of pressure is not a real thing when it's legit. I mean, obviously there's a timeline, but it's not like you've got to make your mind up now kind of.
No, that's typically a red flag. And sometimes I get contacted by clients where they'll be like, I've had this deal for a week and I just discovered you through whatever. And so they sent it to me on like Thursday, and they're like, oh yeah, the label needs it signed by end of day tomorrow. And I'm like, whoa, 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 like pump the brakes. You know, let's take a couple weeks here to dig into this, draft a markup, you know, give me some background, whatever. Because this is your life. I mean, for an artist, your typical record deal is going to impact at least the next 5 years, but often the label owns the masters forever. Then it's the rest of your life that if you have a big hit or several, they own those forever. So like do the right deal. And then I think just, I always say to my clients, like, trust your gut instinct, because I trust my client's gut instinct. You know, if we've got someone who just is, you know, sort of, you know, tickling your spidey sense, I trust that, you know, let's dig into that a bit and ask some hard questions. And then usually we find, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire, right? So, and I think there's always, if you, just because you got one offer, and like, I love being a deal maker, not a deal breaker. Like sometimes I have to be the bearer of bad news and say, this is a sketchy or horrible deal.
Yeah.
Let's look elsewhere. I don't like doing that. I'd rather make the deal happen. But if someone is interested in you at this point, there's going to be others down the road, and just, you know, or it's better just to keep doing it yourself until a less, you know, exploitative deal comes along, right?
Totally. I guess things are always negotiable too, right? Once you have a deal on the table, to go to someone like yourself and be like, okay, well, I really like this side of things, but can we tweak or change certain other things? That's always an option, right?
Yeah, that's a good point too. I mean, if the other side, and again, you know, I work on both sides of, you know, the table, right? Like I have a lot of label clients and manager clients and publisher clients, but I think in this discussion, we're more so looking at it from the artist perspective, which is fine. You know, if the other side, like the label, says, this is a take it or leave it deal, don't even bother going to see a lawyer because we're not going to change anything, that's a major red flag, you know?
Yeah.
Because on my label clients, it's negotiable. I mean, you know, I think most of the times, I hope if the label's coming from a good faith sort of standpoint, they're not going to like give you a lowball offer and expect that you're going to go from, you know, whatever that offer is to way up here. Like the offers typically, you know, you can't just move mountains on a deal and totally change it. But I think there is parts that it's always negotiable. And especially if you've got some hype happening, like again, a song's blowing up. The best case for me is we got a couple labels interested or a couple managers interested. Then you can sort of make sure we get the best deal. I think just always never hesitate to reach out and get an opinion, especially from an entertainment lawyer or someone you know in the industry, because there's enough people out there that are willing to help that it's really going to be worthwhile.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess on that point, can you kind of explain why it's important to reach out to an entertainment lawyer and not your Uncle Barry who's in real estate law and that kind of thing?
I've had that so many times. You know, here's my Uncle Barry, and he's a divorce attorney. So he's gonna negotiate this deal, and it's gonna be messy. It's gonna be ugly. It's so funny. And honestly, like I say the same thing. If people come to me with a divorce, I'm like, whoa, that's not me, you know. I'll refer it somewhere else.
That's epic.
Because it really, yeah. Or it's like people say, can you help me buy my house? And I'm like, no, it's not my expertise, right? And, you know, let's get a real estate lawyer who's a professional who knows it, right? So, I mean, and it's funny because there's not a lot of entertainment lawyers in the country, right? And like I work at, you know, one of the larger law firms, Miller Thompson. We have 535 lawyers.
Wow.
And no one, maybe one other person, but aside from no one does what I do really, right?
Okay,
and they all think what I do is really cool, as you know, it is compared to a lot of types of law. But they're all like, I know nothing about what you do. And I say the same to them, right? So you need an entertainment lawyer, someone who, because you can read a contract and look for like obvious things, right? But if I read a 40-page lease, if you're leasing a property, I don't know what I'm looking for, right?
Totally.
Like, if I see a spelling mistake, I can point that out, but I can't tell you what the industry standard terms would be or, you know, again, and based on experience, like I've done this about 15 years. I mean, you just see things. It's kind of like I told my son the other day when we were driving, he's like, how did you know that person was going to cut you off? I was like, well, just from experience, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of like, it's a metaphor for the music biz of what I do. It's like, I know something's going to be sketchy with this clause because I can see where it's a bit of a gray area, but you know, yeah, Barry, the real estate lawyer's not gonna get that, right?
It's and that's just wild. Like, as well, I guess with entertainment law and say real estate or whatever, divorce lawyers, the landscape is always changing too. There's so many That's things right. that are changing all the time in the entertainment business with regards to, like, I mean, just a streaming, for an example, all the different things that are changing in that kind of capacity. So you must have to kind of keep your eye on the ball, like, a heck of a lot more, say, than someone who is working in real estate, where I don't think I don't know much about, I know actually probably more about entertainment law than I do about real estate law. Oh, and I'd assume that things move a lot faster over in entertainment law and change a bit than they would in the other side. So you're probably monitoring a lot of stuff too, hey?
You're so right. I think things are changing every day in the music biz, you know, and like even just keeping on top of like sound exchange revenues right now are so huge for Canadian artists. And so every time your song is spun on satellite radio, I mean, you get $40 to $50, you know, unless you sign these rights away or your label signs these rights away, and then you end up getting like, you know, a dollar. So it's these kind of things are really important. And but you're right, I think it's all about, you know, I mean, the music biz is my life, and as it is yours, and so I'm just sort of like reading about it every day, and I just love it, right? So I say to artists, I mean, find an entertainment lawyer who you trust and who knows the industry, and then ideally you like them too, because just like signing, like, you know, finding a bandmate, I mean, you want someone who's talented, but you also want someone you enjoy spending time with, because you're going to be on calls and whatever, right? So that helps if you like them and they're great at what they do.
So important to have that chemistry and that rapport, and be approachable and be able to ask questions that maybe you feel are stupid questions, but they're not, and just to have that open kind of communication too. The music came first, and then you got into the law. So tell me a bit. Let's talk about the music. How did you get into music? How did you become a drummer? When did you first pick up sticks?
Yeah, so, you know, I was a late bloomer. I started in grade 12. I picked up sticks, which, you know, I was the least, like, all my friends had, or a lot of my friends, like, you know, we all knew people in high school who had been playing since they were like 7 or something or whatever, right? I wasn't that kid. I thought they were the musicians, and I was just not. But I was a big music fan. Early 90s, Seattle was a huge influence on me. So Pearl Jam at first, and they were like a huge influence. And then, you know, Soundgarden, Nirvana, Alice in Chains, like those bands changed my life. And I thought, well, like, you know, why don't I just, you know, I'm such a fan, why don't I just play along to the record? So I bought a cheap drum kit and bought these headphones that were kind of like noise isolating, so I could hear the record. And it was often playing to vinyl, which I was a big vinyl fan. And I'd plug it in and play along. And that's, I didn't take lessons, not till later. But I just really, it was such a release. And I think that in high school, I mean, for anyone, it's, you know, a tumultuous time. But for me, it was just, you know, that really was just sort of gave me my voice and helped Love me sort it. Of find myself, right? And but then, of course, I started playing and, you know, I sucked, right? So
that's how we all start.
Exactly, you know, and it's probably 2 years where I really did suck. But I mean, I wouldn't know or care if you told me I did, right? Like I loved it. You know, it was a true just love. And so I started with easier, say, Pearl Jam songs and whatever. And then eventually after, and I'd play like, you know, 7 hours a day.
Wow, that's
and
awesome.
Eventually just started to suck less, right? Right, and then you eventually start trying to play along to Led Zeppelin or The Who or, you know, Jimi Hendrix. And so that's how it all really came to be. And people, you know, and then all of a sudden I came out of nowhere in terms of the local scene. Like, you know, I was a nobody and I sucked. And then I just went away for a couple of years and just did it, right? Like, it's like, you know, Muhammad Ali always said, like, it's all about, it's not what you do in the ring, it's what you do outside the ring when no one's watching, right? And then you get in the ring when everyone's watching and just deliver. And that's kind of, I say that to every musician, you know, it's never too late to start. And of course you're going to suck. Even the Beatles sucked. Yeah. And, you know, even Led Zeppelin sucked when they start, you know, it's like, you have to put in the time, right? So, and then, you know, had some bands sort of in university, and then eventually, you know, just sort of, I was in law school. This was like 2003. I started law school, and, you know, I was the only guy, I had hair like I do now. And I was like the, you know, it's sort of the, I stood out in law school,
right,
we'll say that.
For sure.
You know? I was the rock and roll guy. I guess I've always been, in whatever field I'm in, I'm always like the rock and roll guy, which I wear that proudly, you know?
Love it.
And around that time, so it was 2005, so I was halfway into law school, and we formed One Bad Son, and that was, you know,
yeah, there it is.
One Bad Son was similar to my drumming story, is that when we started, we really sucked. You know, you know, I think Shane would admit, and we had, I would say we had all the ingredients, we just didn't have the right recipe, you know?
I love that. I love that. That's a really good metaphor. That's so cool. Yeah. So then, like, you guys have had a lot of success. When did it first take off and what did that feel like? And I guess, were you guys in a position where you were like, okay, we need our team or we need that representation and stuff? When did that happen for you guys as a band?
You know, I joke that it took me 2 years to sort of not suck as a drummer when I started with One Bad Son. It took us 8 years to get our first song that broke through. Right. So,
yeah.
It took even longer, but I think that's it's also what makes Shane and I so grateful for everything. And I think fairly humble, you know, it's like we had to earn every fan, right?
Yes.
And it wasn't like it was overnight success. I mean, it was 8 years of grinding and like I booked all the shows in the early days. I was sort of the manager and we'd drive, you know, 14 hours to Thunder Bay to get paid $500, which of course doesn't cover even gas, right?
Yeah.
And play to 20 people and the owner isn't a fan because you didn't bring any people in. And, all that stuff, right? Like we did that for 8 years.
The joys of music. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Well, and it turns out, I mean, it took us 8 years and I can't even imagine how many kilometers, but eventually we learned how to write catchy songs, right? Learned how to write hooks and put those ingredients together, and we found our recipe, right? So that was 2012. We broke through with a couple top five songs and we got signed to 604 Records in Vancouver, and so that was like, that was the big change, right? But again, it's, I tell these young bands, I'm like, it took us 8 years to get there and to learn how to write songs, like to learn how to really write our songs, right? Like whatever that thing was that we do. It took us a while to find that recipe. And I think everyone's different. We had recipes in the early days and they just weren't very good. You know? So I think that's like, yeah. And then from there, I mean, we now we're in our 20th year. It's kind of crazy.
That's
so
amazing.
We broke through and I was 8 years in. So we 12 years we've had sort of, you know, since we broke through. And it's been a wild ride. We've had, you know, we toured one a year. I remember we toured like 9 months of the year or something.
Wow.
We were just complete road dogs and but that's how you do it as a rock and roll band,
totally,
right? I mean,
totally.
That's how you build the fan base.
I was reading just now that you you also have performed on the same bill as the Rolling Stones. That's wild.
Yeah, that was cool. That was their only, like their last Canadian show, and it was like us, Glorious Sons, The Beaches.
Cool.
And it was like 70,000 people or something, so
that's fun.
Those kind of things, like I'm such a Stones fan. I've had every record. Yeah. Those were some records I'd play along to in the early days, right? And you know, I was really trying to meet Keith or Mick. Charlie. I would take any of them, but it was like CIA level security.
Yes.
And I got to the head of security, and I was like, I'm a huge fan, a lifelong fan. And I was pushing to meet Keith because I thought that'd be fun, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
I was like, can I please, I've got every record. I played along to these records and can I please meet Keith? And the security guy's like, well, it's a good story, son, but Keith Richards has met everyone he needs to meet in this life.
That's a great answer.
And I was like, well, but he hasn't met me. He just, he laughed and said, sorry. But I tried. That's the important thing. You know?
That's it. You got to try everything. But really to have that opportunity and to be on that kind of stage and playing for that sort of number of fans, that's insane. That's so much fun. Do you prefer, like, having done that side of things, would you love to always play for massive crowds, or do you like enjoy the kind of gritty, like, smaller shows? Like, what's your favorite kind of setup?
Great question, because I mean, like, you know, I think the smaller shows are way more intimate, you know. Like, you can actually feel the audience energy, like right there, right? Like you can shake the hands and like you're right there and you feel that sort of intensity. And like I remember Roger Waters said, like, you know, when they blew up and became a stadium band, and they were like touring the wall or something. He remember he like spit in some fan's face because he was just, he felt like they were being rowdy and he just felt so disconnected from them. Whereas in the club, in their club days, he never would have done that, right? He's more connected with the audience. And so it's just a metaphor for how he just becomes so detached from and disconnected from the audience.
Yeah.
I would never spit in someone's face, that's for sure, but that's Roger Waters for you. But those stadium shows, like, they really stand out. But we've also, we've done way more of the smaller shows, like the 500 or 800 cap. So those, the stadium shows, like when we did, you know, first time we toured arenas with Def Leppard, it was amazing. And I remember every night we'd go on stage and like my arm hairs would stand up, you know, it was just like, and to walk on stage and hear that, just the size of the audience. So I'll never get sick. I'll never turn down those kind of shows.
Yes.
But it is those club shows, like we just played last weekend actually in Edmonton, to 500 people. We sold out a 500, you know, cap. And the crowd was so live. It felt like way more than 500 people, you know?
Absolutely.
And then I always walk out and before the encore, I walk out and give everyone a hug. And like, it just feels way more connected to the crowd, you know?
Absolutely.
So, I mean, I love both, which is not a very committal answer, but I love both. And, I don't take either for granted, you know?
They're both incredibly, incredibly different. So yeah, no, that's super, super cool. So, what was your favorite biography? You mentioned you were reading biographies when you first got into it. What was your what's your standout? Who's your favorite?
You know, when I was younger, Keith Moon's biography, which was like this big.
Yeah.
Like, it's so like, you know, I remember Pete Townsend's biography was like this big and Keith's was like three times the size, which I found ironic because Pete wrote all the songs, but Keith was just this wild man. So I was sort of fascinated with Keith Moon. I went through a phase where I wanted to be him, not so much on the like, you know, he was a complete raging alcoholic and not the greatest friend or father or husband, but he was just a wild man on the drums. And I went through a phase where, you know, I just emulated Keith Moon, you know, that in that way. So that was probably the most fun read, although it's also sad because, of course, he, you know, the vices kill him in the end. Spoiler alert. but you know, the most intelligent, I would say, was Bob Dylan's Chronicles. And that wasn't when I was younger. I mean, well, that was maybe I was like mid-20s when it came out. But it's just, I mean, Bob Dylan to me is like just the peak in terms of songwriting. And he's so intelligent. So I think those... You combine Bob Dylan and or the vibes of Dylan and Keith Moon, and that's like, those are big influences on me. You know?
Love it. Yeah, Keith Moon doesn't surprise me there. That's awesome. That's so cool. Yeah. We have two goats. We have Bonzo and Mr. Moon. So
you've got great taste.
Absolutely. Yeah, and they are equally as crazy as their namesakes. So yes, that all works perfectly. But what would you have said to young Kurt back in the day when you were getting into the industry? And are there any moments that you're like, you know what, I really should have done that differently, or I should have seen that red flag, or that was the best risk we ever took? What's a standout moment for you in your career, either in the legal side of things or as a performer, that was like, yeah, that was the right thing, or that was definitely the wrong thing to do?
Yeah, you know, honestly, I don't look back. There's no big major like regret or like I should have done something different. But I think, you know, if I were to give my younger self sort of advice, I mean, just always do your like trust your gut instinct and stick to your like. And I say this to other musicians too. I think that's what I'd say to other musicians. Just there's only one you, right? And we live in such a world where everyone just emulates each other, and it's sort of, a lot of it's derivative, and like you want to chase whatever's cool right now. And there's only one you, and as an individual, but also as a band. Like what I say to this to bands, like what makes you special, right? There's four of you or three of you, whatever, and like what makes you special, right? Mm-hmm. What made Queen so amazing? Well, it's the four of them, and they're the greatest frontman and all that stuff. But if they tried to be someone else, it just wouldn't have worked, right? Or even the Stones are a good example. It's like Mick on his own, so-so, Keith on his own, so-so, but you get them together, and it's Charlie's like good drummer, but like great drummer, but you know, it's when they're together is what makes them so special, right? So I think same with solo artists, you know, what makes you special, what makes you stand out, and don't worry about like whatever, like don't try to be someone else, because you'll fail, right?
Absolutely. That's so funny, because I always joke that like I could have broken up the Spice Girls, because Way back in the day, there was this one time.
I've heard this. Yeah, I've heard about this.
I am a legend. That's so funny. But yeah, I was invited to go meet the group, and they were still looking for their fifth, and it was Emma Bunton. And I'm just kind of like, it's funny because I heard a podcast with Mel C recently, and she was like, I often wonder what I'd be doing if I hadn't gone to that audition. And I'm kind of like, over here, Mel, I can tell you exactly what you'd be doing. But
that's amazing.
But no, I often kind of think, you know, had I joined the band, the reason I didn't go to that meeting is I wasn't ready. I wasn't in that headspace to do all the crazy things that those girls were doing. It just, so who, like, it could have gone in a very different direction. So yeah, like you say, it really is important to have that chemistry and to have that group and to have that, you know, that relationship. Like you say, if you're going to be in a band with people, you're going to be in a stinky bus for half your life together. So it's like, you got to have that chemistry and that connection and the, I think, the appreciation of what it is that makes you the band that you are or the group that you are, because that's what's going to keep you together in the shitty times too.
I love that. So a question then, Emma, if you would have made the Spice Girls, what name would you have been? Like, not Baby, but you, what name would you pick?
Oh my gosh, what would I pick?
What kind of spice would you be?
Oh my God, that's a good question, actually. I've never thought about that. I probably, I think I would have also still been the youngest one. I would have been along the lines of Baby Spice, but I wouldn't have been Baby. I'd have been probably Bratty Spice or
Bratty,
something.
Bratty, I like that. Bratty Spice. It's got more, it's more badass
there.
There
we go, yeah. So yes, that's how that would have ended up. And funny stories. Oh my gosh, we have to talk because there's funny old stories. The school I went to was a very strange school. It was literally, now it's a very posh school, but it was basically where musicians would send their kids and pay a fair amount of money to basically just get them through school. It was like, it was very creative, very artsy, but it wasn't really great when I joined there. But all the kids there were just like, it was like Roger Waters' daughter India was there, and wow. Ronnie Wood's daughter Leah was in my class, and her brother, and Mick Jagger's kids and all that kind of thing. So it was wild. Like, so when I was, say, 15, 16, it's funny you telling the Charlie story, we'd all be around at Leah's house and Mick, and everyone's just hanging out. So it's just wild. Wow. Just very, very strange growing up like that, because that was kind of normal, that's all of our parents, that's kind of the stuff that they did. So it's just, it's all very bizarre, but when I look back on it,
wow, that's so cool. I mean, I know you've hung out with so many of my idols, right? Like, from like that era, from especially in the UK. I mean, that's a big part of what I, you know, grew up listening to, you know.
Yeah. So there's stories, but I mean, I was a teenager, so I don't really know these stories, but it was good times while everyone had very strange parents at the school I went to, so it was pretty cool. But Kurt, thank you so much for this conversation. To kind of summarize, what would you say to someone who's like hitting the ground running right now, really feeling overwhelmed, is like maybe not even thinking they're ready for a conversation with a lawyer because they might not just, it's all happening so quickly. So what would you say to someone?
Yeah, like, I mean, first and foremost, if someone puts a contract in front of you, then don't just trust your gut instinct. Send it to a lawyer, okay? Because like, I've had a lot of artists contact me like, hey, Kurt, like, I've, you know, I've seen you on Instagram. I signed this contract last week. Can you help me? I'm starting to regret it. You know, I'm just like, oh God. Cause I, you know, a signed contract is hard to get out of, right?
Yes,
like,
yes.
That's why they have them. But, you know, so I think, you know, definitely get advice if someone sends you something. I mean, if there's no contract in front of you, but like, if you're feeling overwhelmed or you don't understand how publishing works, or, you know, whatever, I mean, email me or check my TikTok or Instagram. I might have done a video on it.
You've got amazing resources for all of that stuff, and it's really, if you're not sure where to look, you can go down a really, really intense rabbit hole, and then you get even more confused and more overwhelmed. So please do check out all of Kurt's stuff. I'll put links in the show notes for everything, because it's really consumable, understandable, like, and it's all there. So please check that out. Sorry, Kurt, I had to interrupt and tell everyone how wonderful are for a second.
Well, and then I guess, and if it doesn't answer your question, then reach out to me. Like, honestly, I'm pretty, you know, I think perhaps unlike some lawyers, I mean, I'm pretty easy to get a hold of and pretty accessible, and I get back to people. If you shoot me an email and say, I don't understand this, Kurt, like, can you help explain? I'm happy to do that. And I think it's like, keep doing your thing. And when the time comes, like, bring the right people on to your team, right?
Yes.
Whether that's you or whether that's me or whether that's a manager, like, you know, or a booking agent or a record label. I mean, everyone who's made it has a team, a great team behind them. So it's a matter of finding that team at the right time, which is, it's not always clear when that is, but I think the universe will sort of present that to you. And along the way, if you have questions, just reach out, because I honestly, I'm happy to help.
I love it. I love it. Thank you so much, Kurt. Is there anything else you want to share with the audience here today?
I don't think so. I mean, but yeah, I think we just are getting started. So we could do a follow-up sometime. We could do like a deep dive into a certain topic if you want, whatever. But it's great to chat with you. I love it.
Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. It means a lot. Okay. It's really, really awesome. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to today's show. I really hope you enjoyed it. Please feel free to like, share, and subscribe. And if you do leave a review, it's really useful to help others discover the show. You can also check out the weekly vocal workout over on Patreon. I'll leave the links in the show notes, where you can access weekly vocal training from yours truly and totally rock your voice. Thanks again for listening. Check out Rocket Vocal Studios on social and on the web. And I look forward to seeing you again next time.